and welcome to this new podcast of the American Journal of Public Health. And we have the privilege to have today a conversation with Professor Regina Davis-Moss, who just published a book about reproductive health and sexuality of Black women.
Yes, I did. Black women's reproductive health and sexuality, a holistic public health approach. And I'm so excited to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Regina. I'm here with Kate Anderson, our student editor at JPH. She was very interested in the topic, read the book, etc. So we will be interviewing Regina together. So first, Regina, tell us a little bit more about you before we start talking about the book.
Well, I am currently the president and CEO of In Our Own Voice, a National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda, which is the first and only national state partnership that's focused squarely on advancing reproductive justice for Black women, girls, and gender expansive people. But I have to say, I cut my teeth at APHA. I was formerly the associate executive director here for 17 years. I'm formally trained in public health, both my master's and my PhD in maternal and child health. I'm really excited to talk about how my work is helping to bridge the gap between public health and reproductive justice.
So in a few words, what is the book about?
Okay, well, so that's a great question. You know, Toni Morrison famously said, like, if there's a book you, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, but she basically said, if there's a book you really want to read and it doesn't exist, you must write it. Much of the public health space, we're very focused on rates and risk. And frankly, I was sitting at my desk one day, it was March in 2021, and I was watching a podcast and was talking maternal mortality, and it said Black women are X amount of 2 to 3, 4 times more likely to die. And I was frustrated, and I threw my hands up and I said, I need you all to understand that it's so much more than this. And that's really where it started, is just providing the context around why that is, because it's really just not that simple. And that's really the point was, is to help expand the conversation so that we have a better understanding of why these things are happening, and also let people know that there really are solutions that exist right now and how we can get a handle on this frightening and ever-increasing maternal mortality rate.
One thing I really appreciated about the book was how you integrate so many academic and outside of academic perspectives, bringing things in from women's and gender studies, sociology, medicine, from Black feminist movements, and you've distilled this into the 4 sections of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about where those intersect?
Sure. So that's intentional. I want to say when I was thinking about this book, I was thinking about it as a reference and both a compass. I wanted this to be a book that stayed on people's desk so that they could, if they needed to have more information about a particular subject, they could turn to that chapter. But I also wrote it in a way so that if you were new to this space, then you could get the foundational understanding. And by the time you finish the book, you were well equipped. My goal is if you reread this book and you're not moved to action, then I haven't done my job. It's intentionally set up so that the chapters can stand alone, but it also is meant to build upon each other. So the first section is about the foundation. It's intentionally interdisciplinary as well as mixed methodology. So it's qualitative and quantitative, because that's where we really get to hear the voices and understand why things are the way they are. For instance, the chapter on sex workers and in particular trans women, it's a one-on-one interview where you really hear about why we're engaging in that work, why, you know, as public health professionals, we try to encourage to practice healthy behavior. But many people do not know that if a trans woman is found with condoms on their person, they can be thought of as being sex workers. And then they will be oftentimes taken into custody where they're further facing violence. So, you know, that's what we want to do, right? We want to make sure that they can protect themselves because we want to reduce disease, right? But these are the types of nuances that we need to understand when we're designing programs. And we're coming up with these interventions. Anyway, so that's why it's intentionally quantitative and qualitative. As I said, the first section is about the foundational history. It takes you all the way back to chattel slavery so that you understand how the forming of the United States and our democracy was honestly built on the subjugation of Black women's fertility and sexuality. Then we move into narratives, because in order to do that, we had to create a narrative, right? We had to say, one, that these population, we had to dehumanize them, but we also had to say, well, they're already hypersexual. They're already prone to all these things. And so we really spent some time digging down into how that has been so pervasive in media, in a lot of the things in society, in our culture. But we also introduced the concept of intersectionality, because we need to understand that being a Black woman, as well as depending on your income, but the intersection of race, gender, and class shows up uniquely in Black women, and they both exacerbate conditions that already exist as well as perpetuate. So we talk about a lot of those things. And then third section, we move into activism. And so we not only honor a lot of the women that have been responsible for some of these major activism movements in the United States, like Me Too, reproductive justice, amongst others. And so we spend time talking about not only who birthed those movements, but why activism is so critical. And then finally, we move to the solutions. Then we start talking about doulas and midwives and various modalities for engaging in sex education, continuing breast cancer, every issue that is so prominent today. I have got some of the most powerful, brilliant thinkers that I know to talk about these issues, and so that when you're designing those programs, you can know that you're bringing the best science.
In the book, you talk about this Black Maternal Health Momnibus Act. So can you tell us a little bit more about this act and why it is so important?
So the Black Maternal Health Momnibus is 13 pieces of legislation that is, the goal is to try to address the maternal mortality crisis. It was introduced by several legislators. Lauren Underwood, who is one of the lead sponsors of it, knows the story personally. She comes from public health, but Shalon Irving, who was a CDC employee, actually, and one of her classmates when they were in public health school, died after childbirth. And so it touches on a number of things. Number one, social determinants of health, but also talks about, you know, eligibility for WIC. There's some supports around veterans. There are 13 pieces of legislation that, if passed, will make a significant difference in what we're seeing in the outcomes for Black maternal health. Because, you know, we're not just talking about maternal mortality. We're talking about infant mortality. We're talking about a lot of things that I want to make sure people understand is that you can't address this in isolation. There's not one piece of this. And when we know this in public health, right, we understand this so very well, and that the approach has to be multisectoral.
I think that's such an important sentiment throughout this. And the Momnibus Act, which hopefully we will see move forward, will hopefully go a long way towards helping those maternal and child health outcomes. But, you know, as you address in the book and as other authors address, there are so many areas in which there are really severe disparities, and where Black and African American women are not achieving the same health outcomes. Achieving is the wrong word, but are subject to norms that are resulting in more negative health outcomes. And so I'm curious, where do you think public health has failed Black women? The government is hopefully working on this act for maternal and child health. But what about everything else, and what do we need to be doing?
In the context of reproductive health and sexuality, I think what we need to appreciate, and let's talk about it now and what's happened, right? So we saw a major turnout for Ohio and Pennsylvania, very much a referendum on largely people saying reproductive decisions should be my own and the right to bodily autonomy. I need to tell you that Black women have been saying that since almost 30 years ago when reproductive justice was created. But what we were also saying at that time is that it's not just the legal protection to abortion. It's the access. It is all these other things that every woman, poor, young, the like, must take into consideration when they decide to carry their pregnancy. It could be health. It could be largely it's economic. But it could be, you know what, almost 50% of pregnancies are unintended, right? Is my partner going to beat me because they now found out that I'm pregnant? You know, there are a lot of dynamics. There are a lot of decisions that we must take into account. And they're not taken lightly. You know, there's this assumption that, you know, people just wake up one day and say, I want to have an abortion. And that's not what happens.
I went to a panel yesterday, and there was a faculty member who was discussing HIV prevention among Black women. And one of the things that she said that really stuck with me was that She doesn't like the term mistrust because the trust is not misplaced somewhere else. It is based on experiences. It is this distrust that has been earned by medical establishments and to an extent by public health, where Black women's needs rather have not been prioritized. I also went to a lovely session that was called an Alternative Spring Break Weekend for young women, both cisgender and transgender, attending predominantly Black institutions and HBCUs. And they talked about HIV prevention, but they also talked about this mistrust and distrust and the legacies of that. And it was actually hosted at Tuskegee University. And one of the things they talked about is just that, having to really address a legacy of an institute that's not even affiliated with with those events. But this just made me really curious of, what do you think are the lessons for, you know, younger Black women, Black young adults being raised in this environment and seeking to both improve the health of their communities and themselves?
Well, I think to your point that the distrust, mistrust is well earned and that it happens again and again and again. All right. So it's not just historical. It happens. If I go into, I was in a session, and so this was a young woman who was in delivery, and this is a story because one of the things that we try to do as a community is to make sure we're sharing those stories so people know that they're not alone. So that's one thing I would say when, as public health professionals, is that we need to hear those stories and we need to validate those experiences. But in this particular case, this was a young woman that was going into labor, and she had done her research. She did not want any medical interventions. The doctor had somewhere to go, and she wasn't effaced. And so they went to insert a suppository, and she didn't want it, and she protested, and they restrained her. And so now, fortunately, she did go and pursue legal action, but this is not just happening 20, 30 years ago, 40 years, hundreds of years ago. This is happening now. And so imagine what that traumatic experience was like for her. This is somebody that has done the research, trying to move beyond the assumption that we're not informed, and coming in and trying to assert their rights, and someone saying, no, that's not what I want, and I'm going to do what I want to do. So we need to remember that that still happens. We need to remember that, or honor the culture for Black women. And because, you know, we're not a monolith, you know, we come from various parts of the diaspora. Some of us are here for generations, but some of us are not. And so that shows up differently in terms of the approaches we might be trying to promote. But I think just the most important thing is just recognizing that we're like our own experts in our experiences.
And are there some organizations that that person could have reached out to be helped, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, there are grassroots advocacy organizations. There's legal organizations. I'm going to give a plug for my organization in that we do not that sort of like pro bono, or I mean, we're making an assumption she maybe didn't even need pro bono work, but someone that could definitely support her in her claims. My organization is focused on policy. And so if someone is in a community-based organization and they want to know what policy looks like at the national level or at the state level, that's what we do. So we support organizations in trying to introduce model legislation. And we're supporting just not only at the big P level, but at the little P level, right? So that could have been Hearst making sure that there is the opportunity for, you know, other individuals that want to deliver at that hospital to know about her experience. So whether that be some sort of community feedback form, or even being able to provide the feedback to the hospital as a community member of what it's like to deliver in there, and, you know, hopefully be able to report that individual to the medical board so that they're not practicing and doing those kind of things again.
We are going to wrap up. I have one final question. Did you have a public in mind when you wrote the book? Who do you want to be reading the book?
So the book is written for public health professionals in the title, A Holistic Public Health Approach. But in mine, I had gender studies, every aspect of academia, whether that be social epidemiologists, historians, political scientists, community activists, philanthropists, I have a section on philanthropy. So the book is meant to be for everyone, but it's also meant to be for yourself or myself. So there are things in there that I need to know, not only to be a better advocate for myself, but how I can improve myself, my health.
Thank you. I so enjoyed reading through the different chapters, and it, for me, was enlightening and incredibly informative. And thank you for the effort to put that out there.
Well, and thank you. And I would say that book is for wherever you are, seasoned or new to the work, allied or in the trenches. And so we need you in this fight, and keep that book close by.
It is an excellent book, I have to say. And I've heard a lot of comments about it, people telling me that they love this book. And it's been one of the most important reading they had, recently. Wow. So congratulations. That's not easy.
I appreciate that. And I will end by saying, as I said, it was kind of, I've been on a journey. Everyone has their story as to why they come to the work that they do. And mine came from a place of, I saw a lot growing up in Los Angeles in the height of gang activity and the Reaganomics and all those other things, and wanting to make sure that Black women were empowered, that they could step into any place with their full agency. And I encourage everybody to do the same.
Thank you, Regina.
Thank you.
So in conversation with Regina Davis Moss about her book about reproductive health and sexuality in Black Women, A Public Health Approach. And the interviewers were Kate Anderson, student editor at AJPH, a very brilliant one, I have to say, and myself, Alfredo Moravia, editor-in-chief of the journal. Thank you for listening.